Chapter 22, Let's Talk Turkey. 22, by Willie Snow Etheridge. 22, we sail in spite of. Though we had begun to think of the Moline victory would never sail, the roommate even cabled to Louisville for money to buy tickets to fly home, we received word one Thursday that it would probably sail the following Saturday evening. But if not Saturday evening, then surely Sunday morning. So we had better come aboard before 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon, when the customs office closed for the weekend. By now, the baby eagles were flying to the top branch of a nearby fir and perching there all day, evidently too frightened to attempt a return flight until weariness overcame all other emotions and drove them back. While they swayed to and fro on the neighboring fir, Papa and Mama Eagle would often swoop around and around to show them how easy it was to fly and what wonderful fun. They almost made me wish I were an eagle, but I didn't mention this to the roommate, for I was sure he would say, "I wish you were one too." Also, by now, Mr. Big had returned from camp and was staying with Freddie Merrill's 12-year-old son, Ricky, sailing and swimming the days away. But when we told him the ship was almost ready to leave port, he said it suited him. He would like to return home and see his friends. So happily, we parked, dashed to dinners to say goodbye, to the bazaar to buy one more pair of bohemian vases and one more goat rug, and at last, the quivering bird, the roommate, had come through. Then it was 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon. Like a breeze, we passed through customs and headed for the Moline Victory in a gay red and white launch. The ladder was already down when we reached the ship, and the captain was at the top of it waiting to welcome us. "Captain Christie," the roommate said, and I found myself peering a foot or more above me into a handsome blonde face. What a pleasure, I thought to myself, to sail with a captain who looks exactly as every captain of a ship should, but so few ever do. Captain Christie is of Norwegian stock and is 6 feet and some inches tall, with bright blue eyes and thick, wavy blonde hair. He showed us to the two comfortable cabins on the ship reserved for guests. All other sleeping space on the Moline is occupied by the officers and crew. The Moline is strictly a freighter and normally carries no passengers, but it does have two spare cabins for officials of the Prudential lines, or for persons that the company agrees to carry for some reason or another. On the trip out to Greece, the roommate, Mr. Big, and I were the only passengers, but on the Moline there was a little old Turkish woman coming to the United States to visit a brother whom she had not seen in 30 years. She had haunted the Istanbul officials of Prudentials for so many months that they had finally agreed to let her sail in the hospital ward. Quickly, we unpacked so that we would be finished before the engine started and could be on deck as we sailed out of the harbor. But we need not have hurried. We did not sail Saturday evening, nor the next morning, nor the next, ... The unloading was not progressing as well as the captain had expected. There was only one lighter alongside into which to unload long steel girders to be used in the construction of a transformer line, and it was partitioned through the middle so that the girders had to be snaked into the hole. Usually it took 20 minutes to hoist one sling of girders out of the moline hole and to lower them into the lighter, but it could take an hour. With the girders swinging perilously in the slings high above deck, the Turkish foreman and the stevedores would argue over the best way to get them into the barge. Such shrugging of shoulders, such waving of arms, such shouts. The only quiet stevedore, and he was quiet only during the call to prayer, was a devout Moslem with a dirty rag around his head. Completely oblivious of the girders and booms traveling above him, he laid out a couple of boards on deck, having no prayer rug, knelt towards Mecca and prayed. The roommate, Mr. Big, and I leaned for hours upon the bulkhead watching the goings-on. They were as fascinating as the bulldozing of an excavation for a new building. Now and then the captain joined us, but he had little time for watching. Besides the problems of unloading, he was troubled about one of his mates who was tottering on the brink of DTs. The first evening, when the roommate and I were in the captain's quarters, the mate staggered in, sank into a chair in front of the captain's desk, and bowed his head upon it. "You've got to do something for me, Captain," he sobbed. "I'm gone. I'm gone." Tenderly, Captain Christie put his arm around him and helped him up and led him to his cabin. Returning later, he said he had given the mate some sleeping pills. "Poor devil," the captain sympathized. "He's having trouble at home and is trying to forget it by drinking himself to death. He got this way first at Genoa, and now he's back at it. He's in bad shape." He grew steadily worse the next day. In the late afternoon, I met him in one of the narrow corridors, and he lunged toward me but missed. As I flew toward my cabin, he cried out, "Don't be a frightened lady. I have all respect for you." By Monday, he was in such serious condition, the captain decided he would have to take him off the ship and put him into an Istanbul hospital. He felt it would be dangerous to try to get him back to the States. He might jump overboard on the way. But to leave a member of the crew in a foreign port is an involved red tape business. The captain had to spend the whole day at it. He must first go to the consulate and give a full report of the affair and arrange all financial matters. And then he must go to the Turkish immigration officials and get permission to land a man. And then he must see doctors and police and heaven knows whom else. At mid-afternoon, he returned to the ship and was soon followed by immigration officials and police. The poor mate was so out of his head he had to be put in irons, but he had enough sense to resist being taken off the ship. He crouched halfway down the ladder, suspended above the water, and refused to budge further. Crew members coaxed him, but he clung stubbornly with his handcuffed hands to the ladder's rope. I could see the muscles in his broad shoulders straining beneath his leather lumber jacket. It was too tragic for me to continue to watch. I moved to the other side of the deck, but the roommate told me that the mate finally had to be taken off by force. A little later, when the stevedores knocked off for the day, we were still not unloaded. The next day, though, we could see the end of it, and the captain was sure. Indeed, he was so sure he hung the sailing board at the head of the ladder announcing, "The Moline Victory sails July 24th at midnight for Derinche." Sign Derinche, or Derinche. The sign put the roommate into the best of spirits. Relaxed, he studied through the captain's binoculars the activities of the 6th Fleet of our Navy, which had anchored near us in the harbor. Having served in the First World War as an ensign, which I, in my naive way, after all, I was a young girl and in love, believed was the next rank to an admiral. He takes a proprietary interest in the Navy. At one high point, he spotted the Hiawatha carrying the ambassador out to the flagship to pay an official call on the admiral of the fleet. And a few minutes later, we heard the 15-gun salute proclaiming the ambassador was coming aboard. In our mind's eye, we could picture the ceremony. Mr. Wadsworth had described it for us at Ankara. The admiral would be staying with him at the Istanbul consulate, but that would not affect the protocol of the occasion. At one hour, the admiral would leave the consulate for his flagship, and the next hour, the ambassador, dressed in mourning clothes, would follow him, shake his hand, and make a little speech of welcome. Suddenly, the roommate noticed that the flags of the fleet were flying at half-mast. "What goes on?" he wondered excitedly. "Who is dead?" He sought out the radio operator. Had he heard anything? Yes, he had just received a flash that Admiral Forrest Sherman, Chief of Navy Operations, had died of a heart attack in Rome. Soon afterward, the Moline's flag, too, was lowered. So the time passed until 4 o'clock, the regular hour for the stevedores to knock off. Today, though, they would work, so the captain understood, until they finished the unloading. But the captain had understood wrong. In spite of his protest and then his pleadings, they had stopped on the dot of 4. Now it would be another day and another $2,300 of demurrage. The next morning, the sailing board read, "The Moline Victory sails today, July 25th at 3 o'clock for Derinche." or Durenche. But again, we weren't ready. For one thing, the unloading was still unfinished, and for another, the air compressor in the engine room had collapsed. Just what and why is an air compressor is a mystery to me, but evidently it is something vital. Early in the morning, the chief engineer rushed into Istanbul to see what could be done on an emergency basis, but he returned around noon with little accomplished. I was given the bum's rush, he mourned to the roommate and me, running his hand through the untidy chest, through his untidy chestnut-colored hair. I went first to the shipping agents, but they wanted no part of it. I must get the old man, this is what seamen call their captain, but if I were a captain, I would object, to authorize fixing it. But I couldn't find the old man. He was somewhere in Istanbul, seeing about the mate, but Istanbul is a hell of a big place. Finally, though, I located him at the consulate and got the authorization. Then I had to go to a machine shop to get an electrician, and then I had to go to customs for permission to bring the electrician on board. And now I'm waiting permission from customs to take the compressor off the ship and land it. The electrician says it will take 6 or 7 days to fix. God, what a mess. In New York, they could fix it in 24 hours. Do you mean we've got to stay here 6 or 7 days more, the roommate all but shouted. No, if we get it off, we'll let them send it to Izmit. Oh, hell, no, that's much too soon. We'll never get it done by then. They'll have to send it to our next stop, Iskenderun. How would they send it? By plane, train, truck, horseback, anything, just so long as they get it there. Is it so necessary that we have to have it, I asked. I'll say it is. We've got only one dinky compressor left. It would take 5 or 6 men full-time keeping our compression up all over the ship. We have all sorts of trouble. We'd have all sorts of trouble. We'd just have to limp home. So suppose the compressor doesn't get to Iskenderun, the roommate asked. God knows what we'll do. In the late afternoon, the authorization came through and the compressor was taken off. Then shortly afterward, the last piece of cargo for Istanbul was unloaded. It had taken 18 days to unload cargo that, according to the ship's crew, the stevedores in New York had put on in 5 hours. At 6:08, we cast our lines off the buoys, hoisted anchor, tooted mightily, and turned our bow toward the Sea of Marmara and the Gulf of Izmit. It was this gulf, poking into Asiatic Turkey, that had so mystified the roommate and me on our trip to Ankara. We were to sail the full length of the gulf, and there at its head we would find the town of Izmit, formerly Nicomedia, our next port of call. Durenche, or Durance, the name on the sailing board, was simply a control point for large navy installations near the upper end of the gulf, where we must stop long enough to take on navy officers who would see that all cameras and radios were locked away. From there on, we wouldn't be allowed even to receive messages on the ship's radio. No ship in a foreign port is ever allowed to send messages, you know. We raced with the sun at our maximum speed, 18 knots, for Durenche. For if we arrived after sunset, the officers would not come aboard until the next morning, and we would have to anchor there for the night. Quickly, the soaring spires and curved domes of Istanbul dropped behind us. For once, Lady Luck was with Captain Christie. We reached Durenche just before the sun sank behind a jutting point of land. Nonchalantly, the officers climbed the ladders to our decks, inspected all things that needed to be inspected, and sealed all things that should be sealed. Captain Christie was impatient at the delay. Like a big bell, he swung from one side of the bridge to the other. Izmit was 10 miles further on, and he was eager to reach there before black night. I paid little attention to the inspection, but simply seated myself and the gentleness and wistfulness of wide stretching water and open rolling land, saying adieu to the sinking sun. Slowly, the water was drained of bright color, and on shore the tumbling baby hills drew over them gossamer throes of softest lavender. When we were free to proceed, we could no longer hurry. The gulf was mined, some of the crew said, but I was never sure of this. I didn't want to be sure. I tried to concentrate on the lingering twilight. The sun close above the hills was blue, but turned to pink as it curved upward. Now the pink darkened to purple, held true for a brief span, and then faded into a luminous bluish gray. Our bright star tiptoed out and trembled. One bright star tiptoed out and trembled, hovering close to the horizon. Soon the night was black and cold, but I continued to stay on deck, and I glimpsed Izmit spangled against the high, curving bosom of the land. No buildings were visible, just strands of golden lights. End of chapter 22.